Peter B. Collins with news and commentary, Thursday, February 2nd. And we open today with Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part 2. I hate this song. As a young disc jockey, when it first came out, I was required to play it over and over again. And I never got it. But I want you to know that the Puritans who control America's National Football League have decreed that this song will not be heard at Sunday's Super Bowl. And that's because Gary Glitter's been convicted in England of child pornography and committing obscene acts with children. And he was, I guess he's out now, but he was ordered to serve 3 years behind bars. And despite the fact that the Patriots have used this song every time they scored a touchdown, it will not be heard. And, of course, Bible thumpers will have another reason to be offended by the proceedings at halftime at the Super Bowl on Sunday, because super slut Madonna will be performing, and one of my sources indicates that this is one of the songs that she'll open. She'll open the halftime show with Vogue. And now that you know, you don't have to watch. And I'm wondering if the NFL and the TV networks have required Madonna to post some sort of a million-dollar bond in the event of a wardrobe failure. I mean, after what happened to Janet Jackson, and given Madonna's penchant for taking her clothes off and performing in the skimpiest possible outfit. And remember the near porn book that she published a few years back? Well, I think it's all pretty amusing, frankly. And we're going to be watching a little bit on Sunday, since my San Francisco 49ers are not in the Super Bowl. Ordinarily, I'd go skiing. But I think I'm going to go sailing on San Francisco Bay because the weather is going to be so beautiful here on the West Coast. And Indiana's Governor Mitch Daniels, somewhat reluctantly, I guess, has made the Hoosier State the 23rd right-to-work-for-less state in this country. Succumbing to the powerful forces of the Koch brothers and the orchestrated anti-union efforts across the nation over the past year, Indiana has signed the bill, and they did it just in time for the Super Bowl because they didn't want to invite more protests. And union officials say that while they will protest, they will not try to ruin the event. So I think it's a sad day for workers in the United States. Just another blow to organized labor and those of us who believe that the right to bargain collectively and deal particularly with the huge conglomerated monopolistic companies that operate in the United States today, well, I think it's a basic fundamental right. But in Indiana, no longer available. And we'll see how all that plays out over the next few years. Yesterday, on our news and comment and on our in-depth interview podcast, we talked about the dust-up between the Susan G. Komen Foundation and Planned Parenthood. And the reaction has been strong and continues. As members of Congress, a chunk of members, 22 members there, have signed a letter to the Komen Foundation asking that they reverse the decision and not punish Planned Parenthood. Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, has said that he is going to kick in $250,000 to Planned Parenthood to show his support. Well, you know, how about $1 billion, Mike? You've got it. What are you so cheap for? And others are reacting as well. And, of course, they're hunkered down over there at the Komen Foundation, where a woman named Handel, who once ran for governor of Georgia, is really driving the bus on this. And the reaction orchestrated by the Komen Foundation tries to belittle cancer survivors, people who are currently battling cancer, and others who care about the combined work that Komen did with Planned Parenthood, and they're trying to characterize them as whiners and complainers. And then they trot out the so-called pro-life, anti-abortion cancer survivors. And I'm sorry, I don't want to see a war between people with cancer, people who came through cancer. And all this is being done for political effect. We've also talked this week about Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, who started Sunday with a 60 Minutes interview. And I'm still bugged by the opening question where he laughed off rather than answer the question, how many hot wars is the U.S. actually involved in right now? And at the NATO meetings in Brussels here on Thursday, Panetta was asked by reporters to comment on a Washington Post column by David Ignatius that said Panetta believes there is a strong likelihood that Israel will attack Iran in April, May, or June. Ignatius is not saying who told him. And Panetta said, I'm not commenting. Then he added, what I think and what I view, I consider that to be the area that belongs to me and nobody else. He noted that Israel has stated publicly that it's considering military action against Iran, and the U.S. has indicated our concerns. And a friend of this program, Gareth Porter, an excellent investigative and independent reporter, has said that recently when Martin Dempsey, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, went to Israel, his mission was to notify them that the U.S. will not support that possible pending military action against Iran. I hope that's the case. I hope they stick to that. Meanwhile, more fallout from Panetta's call, actually a prediction that came out on Wednesday, that combat forces of the United States and NATO will start leaving Afghanistan in 2013. Now, it's a very fuzzy prediction on the part of America's Secretary of Defense. But there's a very interesting report from NATO based on not a poll. This would not qualify as a poll. They interrogated 4,000 alleged members of the Taliban and other insurgent groups, and they interviewed them 27,000 times. So an average of 7 interrogations or interviews per prisoner. And what emerges is that members of the Taliban are very confident. They believe in their mission. They know that we are leaving. And they're quite optimistic that ultimately the Taliban will regain control of Afghanistan. And this from today's New York Times. The report provides a sobering counterpoint to the decidedly more upbeat public assessments of progress that have recently come out of NATO. It abounds with accounts of cooperation between the insurgents and local government officials or security forces, as well as accounts from Taliban detainees who claim that in areas where coalition soldiers are withdrawing, the Afghan military is cooperating with the insurgents to hand over control to them. The report says many Afghans are already bracing themselves for an eventual return of the Taliban. The Afghan government continues to declare its willingness to fight, yet many of its personnel have secretly reached out to insurgents, seeking long-term options in the event of a possible Taliban victory. The report's findings roundly challenge many of the assumptions on which U.S. policy in Afghanistan is based. That the U.S. military might will force the Taliban to the negotiating table, that the coalition's counterinsurgency strategy will increase support for the government among Afghans, and that as NATO troops leave, Afghan security forces will be able to take over for them. It's all bullshit. And I hope that doesn't offend you, but I'm sorry, that's the only honest way to characterize the situation in Afghanistan. Obama has blundered in putting more troops there and extending our commitment. Karzai says he wants us there for at least another 10 years. And I think that's the more likely prospect. As you probably know, I am what they call a 9/11 truther. And my position is that we don't know what actually happened and who did it on September 11th, 2001. I've carefully examined and watched the proceedings of the 9/11 Commission. It was a whitewash. They covered up things left and right. And we know that. Everybody knows it's a cover-up. But still, people cling to the myth that was spun and then embraced by the media and has yet to be challenged in any meaningful way. There's a cottage industry of truthers out there who have shown where the real questions are and how we haven't been told the truth. And we deserve a full and new investigation. But today, a federal appeals court sanctioned lawyers who brought a lawsuit accusing former officials in the Bush administration of orchestrating the September 11 attacks. This was brought on behalf of a woman who was injured at the Pentagon on 9/11. Her name is April Gallup. The lawyers accused Dick Cheney, the vice president, and Don Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, of causing the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in order to create a political atmosphere that would allow the U.S. government to pursue domestic and international policy objectives. Now, I don't personally have proof of the allegation I just read, but I consider it a likely possibility. And again, we deserve to know the truth, and this is the kind of case it was brought as a civil action, which allows for a great deal of discovery and has a lower threshold of culpability. Instead of the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, the decisions, the determinations are made on the preponderance of the evidence. And it's one thing to dismiss this case, and a district court judge did in 2010, and he ruled that it was frivolous and a product of cynical delusion and fantasy. And then a three-judge panel in the Second Circuit upheld that decision, imposing $15,000 in sanctions on the lawyers for filing the suit. And in addition to that $15,000, they are now supposed to pay double what the government spent defending the case. Now, I believe this case deserves to be heard and that we're entitled to know the truth about what happened on 9/11. And we see courts lining up to protect us from that truth. Well, here in California, we have a rogue utility, and it's providing the power that's got my lights and computers and all my gear on right now. It's called Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And boy, is it a mess. Let's count the ways. First of all, the PUC has been declared by the state of California as a lawbreaker. What it means is, well, there are a couple of different angles here. There was an incident in San Bruno, California in September 2010 where a gas pipeline blew up. Nine people were killed, many were injured, and tens of homes were lost. Turns out that PG&E had not properly inspected that pipeline, and it doesn't even have accurate records of the state of the pipelines that it has running underground here in about two-thirds of California. And we know that the Public Utilities Commission here in California has not properly regulated PG&E. And one of the problems is that the chair of the PUC is a former utility executive. His name is Michael Peavy. He used to be the CEO of Southern California Edison. He thinks like a utility executive, not like a consumer watchdog. And he put himself in charge of the process of determining how much to fine Pacific Gas and Electric for its failure to properly and safely run its pipelines. And what we have learned, and I give the San Francisco Chronicle, and in particular reporter Jackson Van Derbeken, a lot of credit, because we've learned that PG&E had a bonus program that it paid to executives essentially for doing less pipeline inspection. That's right. They had a pool of money that came from ratepayers to inspect the pipelines, and instead of doing that work, they gave bonuses to the executives who created the policies and the plans that reduced the number of inspections actually carried out. Now, I think that approach is criminal behavior. And I personally see a racketeering, a RICO lawsuit there. A RICO prosecution. I don't know if that will actually happen. But we have additional problems as well. Who's going to pay for the pipeline repair and the upgrades to the California pipeline, gas pipeline system? Well, PG&E is fighting over that, and they want to jam as much as they can on the utility ratepayers. And with Michael Peavy chairing the Public Utilities Commission, we can expect that PG&E is going to prevail in one form or another. And they will pay less than you and I might believe they should. The other big blunder of PG&E is the rollout of the so-called smart meter. And these are two-way meters that allow the homeowner to see the exact consumption that he or she is experiencing at any given time. And it allows PG&E to read those meters remotely using a wireless system that has many people up in arms. They believe that the wireless signal creates a health threat. And I've talked to enough people who suffer from this that I believe it's real. It may be a small percentage of people who are subject to it, but it's not a fantasy. It's not something that is simply made up. The other factor is that most people will report that when they switch from an analog meter to a smart meter, their utility bill goes up. So now, the same Public Utility Commission, chaired by Michael Peavy, former utility executive, has said that people like me who don't want a smart meter can pay the utility a one-time fee of $75 and then $10 a month for the rest of the life of my old meter. Now, I'd be willing to read the meter, take a picture on my smartphone, and send it to him for free. But damn it, I should not have to pay for a service that is not currently based on an extra fee. And there are other ways besides using the wireless system that they could read the meters. And I think that this is punitive on the part of PG&E and the PUC, punishing the customers who don't want a smart meter, either for health reasons or other concerns. And as I wrap up today, here's a little spoof commercial that I recorded about a year ago, and it's remarkably relevant today about PG&E and their smart meters. Check it out.
Pacific Gas and Electric says a big thanks to all the customers who've allowed us to install a smart meter without any of the whining and belly aching we're getting from the greener-than-thou morons who call us on their high-radiation cell phones to complain about the itty-bitty radiation from transmitters on our smart meters. We don't really know if the radiation from smart meters is dangerous, but we'll get around to testing them after we figure out where all the damn gas pipelines are. But don't worry. PG&E is fully committed to fat profits and public safety in that order. The stupid people who oppose the smart meters don't understand how much fun it is to see exactly how people use their power. Bob and Sally in Hayward did 482 loads of wash last month. Hey, Bob and Sally, get a laundromat. Adam and Steve in the Castro and Sue in Redwood City were tied last month in the vibrator category. 121.55 hours of pure pleasure. And Jimmy and Gail in Petaluma won the garage door opener category with ease, with 924 openings last month. You go! Smart meters are for smart people. And for the rest of you, we've got some outrageous fees for the dumbasses who want to opt out. One way or the other, you'll continue to be honored with some of the highest electric rates in the nation. PG&E, where the bottom line is our bottom line.
Hey, thanks for listening to my ravings. Will you share them with your friends on Facebook? This is a free podcast. Wing it around the world. I'll be very grateful.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.